To the True Blue LA podcast. The Dodgers are 82-44 after going 3-3 last week and have an 18.5 game lead on the NL West. Today we're going to talk about Hyunjin Ryu, Urias' suspension, Frank Howard, sandwiches, and you, Eric, Steven, have a rant on home runs, which I'm excited to make fun of you because you're a curmudgeon.
Yeah, there's no question. Hello. I'm here to rant.
But before that, I need a CBPU. I'm shortening it now. The Cody Bellinger pace update before we go to an ad.
Wait, can we do merch? The CPBU shirts? Those will be flying off the shelves, no question. Cody Bellinger had a fun week. He is up over 40 home runs now. He's up to 42. He's on pace for 54 home runs and 125 RBIs. And I have some more notes on him after the break.
Kind of a weird week, right? Like we saw a lot of what makes this Dodgers team great, a little bit of where our concerns are, and a lot of the Dodgers are kind of trying a bunch of stuff and some of it's just not going to work.
Right. Well, and also, yeah, like they were 3-3. They started off the week with like two blowout wins. So already you're like, okay, this is going to be a crazy week.
The inspiration for your home run rant later. They hit, I think, 100 in the first games.
Yeah, right. That's right. And they actually out-homered their opponents on the week. Did you see my tweet about this or no?
I did not.
Okay, what would you guess the home run difference was between what they hit and what the opponents hit? Just give me a guess. 15, six games.
15.
That's the gap?
Yeah.
You're close. The Dodgers hit 21 home runs last week. The opponents hit 4. And they were somehow 3-3 because baseball is funny and it likes to mess with your head.
Losses were all sort of their own unique animal. The one in Florida especially, what a weird game.
Yeah, well, that one was like, well, we talked about this, how of the big three like starters, like when who's starting when, Walker Buehler has the greatest like variance of all of them. And he kind of turned into stinker on Thursday. And then, you know, he was okay, but like...
It seemed like the pitching staff availed themselves of the Miami nightlife.
Well, yeah, it seems
Tuesday
so, yeah.
Night or whenever it was.
Well, also, we talked about this too, where over the last couple weeks, like part of the thing with Kenley Jansen, Dave Roberts thinks he's going to be better off getting like regular work. And part of that is like, given some of their blowout wins, there's not always save opportunities. And Dave Roberts' basic thing is like, I'm going to pitch Kenley once a series at least. And in the last few series, that's meant, oh, we need to get him in this last game. And then that meant in a blowout loss on Thursday, he pitched. And then on Sunday, he ended up pitching late in that game when the Dodgers were down. But it's just because that's sort of when they were using him. So I don't know. It was kind of odd, but like, you know, like it was a weird week. So the Dodgers gave up 4 home runs and like the last 3 were the kind of killers. Hyunjin Ryu, we'll get to his pace update, I guess, shortly, but he gave up back-to-back home runs in the 6th inning and broke a tie, and the Dodgers ended up losing that game 4-3. So that was weird. And then the Dodgers were leading on Sunday in the 6th inning, and then Dustin May in his first relief appearance, they're going to sort of try him out there because that's his probably most likely October role. He did not take kindly to that in the first inning of his relief work. He gave up a few hits, a walk, and then a grand slam to a hitter with a sub 600 lifetime OPS in like a journeyman number of years, Rafael Ortega. So that was weird. And of course, like that's sort of why they're trying out Dustin May now in relief, because you can't, you know, it's one, you got to learn these roles and like sort of plan for them. And that's why it's, I guess, was August 17th when he pitched. So we still have 7 weeks left in the season. So he's going to get more relief work, and he's either going to get used to it and he's going to take to it, or he's not, and then they'll figure something out. But that's why they're sort of trying it out now.
Well, that sort of experimentation definitely, maybe not directly, but certainly cost the Dodgers a win and a matchup for the best record in the National League, which affects one of the magic numbers that I know you've started to track all the way now in August.
Right. Well, I've been like concentrating really only on the number to win the division, because there was like this outside chance that the Dodgers could actually clinch the division in August. It's super unlikely now. It was always like sort of unlikely, because that's just like very difficult to do. But like, so the Dodgers still have an 18.5 game lead in the division over the Giants. The Giants and Diamondbacks have been sort of leapfrogging back and forth a little bit, hovering around 500. And so the Dodgers' magic number is 19 over the Giants, and it's 18 over the Diamondbacks. So if we just go with the Giants right now, in August, the Dodgers have 12 more games left. The Giants have 11. So there's 23 events. They don't play each other. So 19 out of 23 things have to go right for the Dodgers to clinch in August. In other words, it's not happening. That homestand in the first week of September remains like the best sort of chance for them to sort of clinch the division. But we'll see when we get there. As far as the Braves, they lost 2 of 3 to Atlanta over the weekend. And that's going to be – that's their like, you know, most likely NLCS opponent if both teams get that far. Then the Dodgers have an 8-game lead over the Braves. So
a 29, you know, magic number.
Right. Still
for you. I'm still pretty good. Eric.
Very good. Very good. So yeah, they're in really good shape in the National League. They're a game behind the Yankees for the overall best record in baseball. So yeah, despite the sort of setback 3-3 week, they're still doing fine.
You mentioned that in addition to Cody Bellinger, we've been keeping track of Ryu's pace update, kind of a not a rough outing, but not what we expect of him for sure.
Right, like that's how good of a season he's had. Right. He gave up four runs in 6 innings, which
the second
not good,
worst outing.
But not like a terrible outing. And then like it's only the third time in 23 starts he's allowed more than 2 runs. So like that's weird. Like so his ERA ballooned up to 1.64. Should be ashamed of himself. How do you even go outside with that kind of ERA? Ugh, terrible. So Mike Soroka of the Braves, who the Dodgers, he pitched Friday, he pitched okay. And he and Max Scherzer are both at 241. They're second and third, I guess. And Jacob DeGrom is 261. Right behind them is Clayton Kershaw at 263, fifth best ERA in the majors at the moment. So,
it's kind of weird over just like a season and a half. We've kind of just moved on to, oh, Kershaw is the third starter in this rotation. And not that he's washed up, but we just kind of moved him, how quickly we moved him to less than Clayton Kershaw status. And sure, he's not at his peak anymore, but his ability to adjust really, especially within the last year, is just remarkable.
Yeah, like the slider's working. His command's been very good. In his last 7 starts, it's 140 ERA. 33.5% strikeout rate. So whatever he's doing, keep it up. He actually started the game on Wednesday in Miami, and he struck out the first 7 batters of the game. It set a Dodgers record to start a game, and he was 1 shy of the major league record. He had Lewis Brinson 0-2 in the third inning, but then Lewis Brinson was a spoil sport and grounded to short. And then Kershaw struck out the next hitter, so he struck out 8 of the first 9. He ended up striking out 10 in 7 really dominant innings that game. So that, I mean, he's pitched against the Marlins twice this year. It's 13 innings, no runs, 20 strikeouts. So not bad.
All right. I'm going to step away from the mic for a little bit, and I'm just going to, I'm going to say 2 words to you, and I'm going to let you go for as long as you want. All right.
Sure.
Home runs.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to say 2 different words and specifically a name, and I was thinking in my head, how dare you? But I know it's already coming. So, okay. So the Dodgers were like home run crazy this last week. They hit 4 home runs the end of the previous week on Sunday. And then I remember, in fact, I'll bring it up now. We talked about they were at 197 home runs on the year, and one of our questions last week was, who's going to hit 200. And I went into all this research, and like the Marlins never allow like more than like they never allow three home runs like at home. Like even as bad as the Marlins are, it's only happened like five times all year. So they're probably not going to get those three home runs on Tuesday. The Dodgers hit six home runs on Tuesday. And you mentioned that not only that who's going to hit the 200th, Will Smith, but you set it up 198, 199, 200. You had Corey Seager, 198, which was correct. You had Justin Turner, 199, close enough because he was like 201. And then Will Smith, 200. Will Smith not only was 200, but he was also 199. So, like, you were on point, man. Like, it was really good. But, like, so four home runs Sunday, six home runs Tuesday, and then four home runs, I think, the next 2 days. And then possibly, was it four more? Yeah, it was four more on Friday. So in all of Major League history, there had never been a team with, like, more than – three games in a row with four home runs. The Dodgers had five games in a row with four home runs. And we're seeing like these sort of like weird, I mean, no one cares about that record. That's not like a, oh man, remember when we were growing up and we talked about all those teams who hit four home runs in consecutive games? Like nobody really talked about that. It's more of a fun fact, but it's like, it seems like every day there's this new like thing. You're like, my God, there's so many home runs. We talked about Cody Bellinger. Look, he's going to, I mean, he's just the likelihood is he's going to break Sean Green's franchise home run record, which is 49. He's already at 42. He hit number 40 this last week. He's the eighth different Dodger with 40 home runs. There's been 14 total seasons. Max Muncy reached his 30th. He's up to 31 now. It's crazy. Like Muncy is like he's the first Dodger to go back-to-back 30 home run years since Sean Green in 01-02. And even in this, like, sort of home run era, like, the Dodgers have sort of dipped their toes in. Like, they've been good as a team recently, but, like, they don't always have the one, like, sort of benchmark guy up there. They did with Bellinger a couple years ago, and I guess Muncy qualified as that last year. But they don't always have a 30 home run guy, so it is still relatively rare, like, in their history. But I just want to go through some numbers here. Like this whole like streak sort of it made my brain kind of snap, which is why I'm talking about it right now. So the Dodgers right now, they lead the National League with 218 home runs. They have 16 more than the number two team in the National League, which is the Brewers. In the American League, only the Twins and the Yankees have more. The Twins are at 240. The Yankees are 227. And keep in mind, it's a DH league. That I would say I would put the Dodgers above the Yankees in that regard. I don't know if a DH would make up the gap of 22 home runs between them and the Twins, but like we're splitting hairs here. But last year, the Yankees set a major league record. They hit 267 home runs. Four teams this year are on pace to break that record. The three I mentioned and the Astros, which are basically like, you know, the three best teams in the league, and then the Twins are like right there. So home runs still really good. They're the best thing you could do at the plate, not knocking them in that regard. It just seems like there's been so many of them. If you look at like the league as a whole, right? This year, well, let's I'm going to start a few years back. So just four of the top five home run seasons of all time have happened in the last 4 years. 2015 was like sort of a normal year, I guess. The league averaged like just over, like it was 1.01 home runs a game. Throughout like baseball history, it's like vacillated. A lot of times it was lower than the home run per game. But once it got to that point, like maybe it got to like 1.1 or something. But these last few years have been sort of rising up and up and up. In 2000, that was like that was the steroid era, basically. Home runs got to 1.17 home runs per game. That's a lot, but that stood until 2017. So, like, no, people were approaching it. It got to 1.16 one of those years, 1.15, close to it. But then, like, in 2017, we shot up to 1.26. That's 8% higher than that previous record. That's a big deal. But it took a long time to get there, so I kind of get it, right? already 2 years later, this year we're at 1.40. Like, that's 11% over the 2017 record. It's 21% over 2016. So, like, and if you look back to 2015, when we were at, like, a sort of a normal level, maybe a little lower, it's 39% higher. That's only 4 years. Like, I just, my sort of thought is, like, how many home runs are too many? Like, I'm not going old fogey here. I'm not saying like, oh, home runs are bad, we need to hit and run, all this stuff. I just wonder, like, if everyone's hitting home runs, why do we care? Like, you know, like, is it that much, that big of a deal anymore? It's hard to, like, when everyone's setting records, do the records mean anything if everyone's hitting home runs? Like, that's where I'm sort of coming from in this.
I don't care so much about the right. I just like hitting. I like seeing the ball leave the park, Eric. Is that so bad?
No, it's not. That's what's the thing. Like, I get it. It's just like, man, like, if
here's the thing. They can't fix the ball until Ryu hits a home run. At that
okay.
Point.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, that's another weird thing. Like, so I know it's like a running joke, like, especially on the Dodger broadcast, but they always like, oh, it's going to happen. Like, you know, here it comes. Like, you know, Ryu's going to hit. But, like, he's terrible. Like, all pitchers are terrible hitters. Like, I don't know. I guess I am becoming old manish because I'm like, man, I just don't get the joke there. Like, it's just like, really? Like, I know they're not serious about it, but it's like, all right, maybe the 17th time we went to this well is too many. I don't know. Nope. Maybe that's. So, some other weird home run stats. So, like, through Sunday, there's been 34 straight days with at least one player hitting two home runs in a game. On last Thursday, there were 9 different players who hit two home runs in a game. Do you have an idea what the previous record was for consecutive? This is another one of those weird records. Like, man, just remember you go to the Hall of Fame, and it's like the first record they show is consecutive days with a player hitting two home runs. But, like, just if you had to guess, what do you think the old record for consecutive days was with the two-home run game?
17.
Okay, again, you are, like, on point in guessing recently. It's very close. It's 20. Okay. But, like, so 34. Like, I'm sounding like Tim Kirkchin right now. My voice is going up 7 octaves. Like, it's just, it's crazy to me. Like, you know, I sort of liken this. I went on a little bit of a Twitter rant the other day. And I liken this to last year, like I've always been a fan of position player pitching because of the novelty of it. And then, like, last year happened, and it seemed like a position player was pitching like every other day. And now I don't ever want to see it again. Almost like it's just, I'm sick of it. Like, it was just okay. I get it. Now every team's doing it. It's dumb. I don't want to see it anymore. So I hope we don't get there with home runs. I don't think I'm there yet, but I'm closer than I thought I would be. The other thing that sort of gets to me is, like, Aristides Aquino on the Reds, which, if you've never heard of him, understandable. He's a brand new player. He has 11 home runs in his first 18 career games, which is a record. But then you look at all these, like, records through X amount of games, and, like, I was looking through the Reds game notes, and, like, he was the quickest to – not 7 home runs, 8 home runs, 9 home runs, 10 home runs, and all this. And then, but I looked at all the records he's beating. They're all, like, within the last 2 years or maybe 3. It was all, like, Trevor Story, Rhys Hoskins, and then this year, Yordan Alvarez. And I think, like, every other day, like the other day with Yordan Alvarez, it's like, oh, another record for Alvarez. He has the most RBIs through 53 career games since Joe DiMaggio. It's like, yeah, you know, like, that standard we all judge hitters by is their first 53 games. I get it, because that's how many games he's played, and it's cool to, like, look it up. But it's like, man, everything's, like, these records are, like, so fast and furiously falling. Like, Cody Bellinger, 2 years ago, he hit 39 home runs, set the National League rookie record. That was a record that went untouched for 61 years. It's already gone. Pete Alonso has 40 this year. He's going to blow by that. I'm not quite old man yelling at cloud yet, but, like, I'm getting closer. And I would like to know what the breaking point is for home runs. I think we're getting closer than we've ever been. We're certainly getting closer than we've ever been before. There's going to be, like, I think close to 1,000 more home runs hit this year than last year. And last year was like a historically great season for that. So, like, that's where we're at. And it's weird. It's just very weird to me is all.
How much we'll end this rant with, I have one question for you. A lot of has been talked about that. Obviously the ball is different this year. I think that's just a given.
It's, I mean, yeah, that's all of it almost.
So that's an interesting question because let's not just this year in isolation, let's say the last 4 years, how much of that is a ball difference versus the sort of the launch angle era where teams are just getting better at developing and better understanding of how important the home run is and how to actually hit it?
Yeah, I think it's been like a gradual thing over the last few years of like not only launch angle, but like I think acceptance of strikeouts and like basically just selling out and going for it, like, and just swing as hard as you can, as often as you can, basically. And when you hit it, good things will happen. And if you strike out, you take that because the gains of the home run. And I get it. And that's fine. I think that's part of it. But like the ball specifically, like, the studies we've seen, this year it's like significantly different from last year. And I know they've talked about the ball in the past. And I think that it's like this ongoing thing. Triple A this year, like the balls are like super weird. Like the offense there is like, it's skyrocketing like on a astronomical level there, which is why like you sort of take some of these Triple A numbers with a grain of salt. Although we've seen like Will Smith was like raking in AAA and he came up and he's still raking. So it's all part and parcel. But I think the main thing is the ball. We've seen this before. Like 1987 was a big home run spike year, like back in the 80s. But it was like that was clearly like a juice ball year. And then it like went back to relatively normal after that for a while. So I think we'll see that this year, going into next year. They'll probably make some changes back to the ball. But yeah, it's weird because like offense isn't like, you know, teams aren't averaging like 7 runs a game or anything. It's not like out of whack in that regard. It's just the style of offense has shifted to increasingly home run heavy. And like, I don't know if that's a problem. It's probably a problem if it like keeps going too far in that direction. But like, I just don't know where that line is. And I'm kind of fascinated to know exactly where the line of like are we too home run dependent, I guess, is the way to put it.
It'll be interesting to compare next year for sure, assuming they make some sort of dramatic change to the ball and how much it compares and how much it doesn't lose again because teams are trying to take advantage of it.
Especially when Cody Bellinger leads the Dodgers with like 27 home runs next year, we're like, what's wrong with Cody Bellinger? Like, yeah.
Got a couple other topics and some questions from Craig after this break. Last news before we get into a rewind, some questions from Craig, and it's not good news. Julio Urías was suspended 20 games. I've been really busy with work this weekend, so I actually haven't gotten much details other than that. I have some opinions, but I'm kind of actually looking forward to you giving me some information before I go too public on those thoughts.
Sure. So this is all stemming. Julio Urías was arrested in L.A. on May 13th for suspicion of domestic battery. The L.A. city attorney at the time, it was some point like a little bit later in May, they deferred prosecution. But he had to meet several conditions in order to sort of meet that. And one was he participated in a hearing with the city attorney. He had to commit, quote, no acts of violence against anybody. And then also complete a 52-week domestic violence counseling program in person and in a group setting. So it's been like weekly meetings with that. He has to like comply with this to avoid getting charges. So while, you know, not charged, he still has to like do things to not get charged. So there's not nothing there, right? And there was like a little bit of confusion, or maybe it was just under the radar, I think, because it really hadn't been reported on much since then, because he was on administrative leave for a week. And then he was activated. And
activated
then
much sooner than other similar cases.
Yes, like a lot of times if the investigation's going on, MLB has extended the administrative leave. Like it did that with Roberto Osuna. He had a much more, and this is where I get, it's the part I sort of hate about this is, we start like ranking the domestic violence, like, you know, that's there's certainly different types and severities, but like, I'm just sort of pointing this out, like Roberto, as soon as they kept delaying, and then he ended up getting a 75-game suspension. With Urias, it was like no talk of suspension, so it wasn't quite over, but it was like, we don't know when it's going to be over. And so the weird part about this with the policy of Major League Baseball that's agreed upon with the players' union, the team itself like doesn't know a ton. I'm sure they get sort of I guess when something's going to come down, they probably get a bit of word. Like, I think – so this happened Saturday. The Dodgers got word Friday night. I don't know exactly when. They did use Urias for a three-inning save Friday night. So, like, it's reasonable to assume that they knew, like, something was happening Saturday. So they're just like, let's use this guy now. And, you know, it's the cold sort of harsh reality of it. But that's also in line with a lot of his previous appearances. So not that big of a deal. So his suspension was 20 games. They treated the 5 games that when he was on administrative leave, it's already served. So it's 15 more games. So September 2nd is when he could return. He can actually be part of a rehab assignment. I think Bill Plunkett mentioned this August 27th. It's not quite a week before, but they sort of set that up. Like, I know a lot of people are not the happiest about that when you're suspended, you can actually go into rehab. But, like, the whole point of this suspension is that he's ineligible for major league games, but they also want players to be ready to play. So I kind of get it, but just ignore that for a second. I just want to talk a little bit about the MLB policy. So this went into effect like 4 years ago. A lot of the things I'm seeing or like the responses I've seen to the suspension, and it's the more one of the more like distasteful things about all of this is when fans like immediately come to the defense of the player just because he's on their favorite team. Like, and not really, it doesn't really matter what the facts are. They're just like, the most common thing is he wasn't charged. Like, why is he getting suspended? He's getting suspended for nothing. Well, you know, look at the previous thing. He was deferred prosecution, right? He has to like go through a checklist of things meeting their criteria to not get prosecuted. So it's not nothing. Also, the policy itself with Major League Baseball, the commissioner has the authority, I'm quoting here, the commissioner's authority to discipline is not dependent on whether the player is convicted or pleads guilty to a crime. So it's different standards here. Urias isn't going to jail because of the 20 games. He's just not able to do his job because he violated an agreed-upon policy on this. So that's sort of where they're coming from. Now, part of the policy, now that he's suspended, he has to go through a what they call a confidential and comprehensive evaluation and treatment program. And I was looking at a little bit how they set this up. So there's something called the Joint Policy Board with MLB. It has 7 members, and it's like the most important members are I don't know who these people are, but there's 3 like experts on domestic violence. And then 2 representatives on the board from MLB and then 2 on the Major League Baseball Players Union. So then like all the decisions sort of go through this policy board, and including like whether Urias is complying and then whether, you know, whether he meets it. If a player doesn't comply, they can like punish him further, that kind of a thing. And then of the 3, there's usually one who like sort of provides the plan to sort of rehabilitate, I guess is the word. It's weird, but that sort of one person is responsible for like overseeing the player's compliance with the plan. So I think about this, like a lot of times we talk about like, especially in Major League Baseball labor, they usually have like an arbiter, and the setup for those is usually, it was always a 3-man or 3-person board. But one was from the owner side and one was from the player side. And the one that really mattered was the actual arbiter himself. So in the policy board, it seems like the people who matter are these three sort of domestic violence experts they have, and they're the ones sort of carrying out the plan. So that's sort of the nuts and bolts of it. Now, the Dodgers, like, they issued a statement. It was a pretty short statement. I'm just going to read it in its entirety. Quote, "While we are disappointed in what occurred and support the decision by the commissioner's office, we are also encouraged that Julio has taken responsibility for his actions and believe he will take the necessary steps to learn from this incident." Now, I mentioned before that the teams are not privy to the investigation as it's happening. So they kind of got word that it was over Friday night, then he was suspended on Saturday. The other thing about this is Urias is eligible for the postseason. And I guess Stan Kasten and Andrew Friedman were in Atlanta over the weekend, and they were interviewed on Saturday as the news came down. And Kasten was asked, I believe, outright, what are you going to release Urias? No. And the basic plan is like, they're going to use him for the playoffs. I think that's sort of the, I don't think Kasten actually said that, but I'm pretty sure it was implied given a lot of the sort of questioning. And I was looking at this. There's only been, as far as I can tell, 12 domestic violence suspensions since the sort of policy came in. And again, I'm not treating this as a ranking, but I will just say of the 12 suspensions that have been handed down, Urias got 20 games. That's the third lowest suspension. Again, not a value judgment, just pointing it out. Steven Wright got 15 games in 2018. Urias Familia got 15 games in 2017. The highest suspension was 100 games, Alex Torres. Odubel Herrera this year got 85 games. And it was 85 games because it was the remainder of the season. And his suspension noted he's also ineligible for the postseason. It seems like that's a case-by-case basis with these, and it kind of depends on the length and the timing. Addison Russell a couple years ago, or I guess last year, he got suspended for 40 games, but it wasn't announced till like after the wild card game, and he didn't play for the Cubs in that. So he was on administrative leave at the time, so they counted the last 11 games of the season plus the wild card game towards the suspension. Then he missed the first 28 games, this year, so that was part of it. But I looked at some others. Aroldis Chapman, he got 30 games in 2016. He ended up helping the Cubs win the World Series that year. He pitched in the playoffs. Roberto Osuna, the year he got 75 games, he pitched in the 2018 playoffs with Houston. Steven Wright, the aforementioned Red Sox pitcher, he got 15 games in 2018. He was actually on the ALDS roster last year, but he got hurt. So eligible, but he just didn't pitch. So that's sort of where we're at. It seems like, Urias is going to be eligible for the postseason. I will say this. The part that sort of irked me the most about this is like was the – MLB Players Association released a statement on Urias' behalf. So it's ostensibly from him, even though the MLBPA is releasing it. So the opening paragraph is this, or it mentions, "It is important to me not to create uncertainty for my teammates as we approach the playoffs. Accepting the suspension is the best path to achieve that goal." So he mentioned that in the first paragraph that he had the right to appeal, and he didn't. But I mean, it was part of because he knew like that was coming down. So like, to me, that was like, a little too much, like see setting himself up as the hero of this story, which he should not do, like not showing any like, conciliatory nature. He mentioned the incident, as he called it, in the second paragraph after he was sort of sorry for the baseball part of it, which another thing that sort of irked me about this, but he said, "Although the authorities determined no charges of any kind were warranted, I accept full responsibility for what I believe was my inappropriate conduct during the incident." So that's like a weird statement in itself. Like we mentioned before, look, they determined no charges were warranted, yet he still has to comply with like this checklist of items. So it's not that there's nothing there. He just has deferred prosecution. So he has to meet criteria to avoid getting prosecuted. So it's not like he's scot-free, which is what that sort of statement implies, which that's it's just a distasteful thing to be when you should be like being sort of sorry for your actions. He didn't seem very sorry in this statement. I think that's what sort of irked me the most.
So yeah, it's roughly what I was expecting, even though I know I was a little busy when the announcement actually came out, and it just pisses me off. The being a major league player is essentially to be a celebrity, and to me that's a privilege and not a right. And it just Molly Knight tweeted a little bit about this that really echoed my sentiments, which this just doesn't make sense. Not that they took so long to suspend him. I understand it's an investigation. The team doesn't have a lot of power while that investigation is ongoing. But once you conclude he clearly did something, again, I don't think this is a ranking thing. I think if you are deserving enough of 20 games, that's not anywhere close to a big enough statement. I don't know enough about the policies to know if this falls on Major League Baseball or if this falls on the Dodgers or where this falls on, but that's not a statement, and it creates this situation where what are we as fans supposed to do? I don't, like, he comes into a game and a big moment in the playoffs, I'm not happy. I don't want to celebrate. I don't want to cheer. And that's sort of that baseball is put above a really big issue in sort of American society, probably world society, honestly, just pisses me off. And I that's not a very rational statement. I'm not trying to make grandiose statements on what should have been done instead, but this does not please. This bothers me a lot.
Yeah, and another thing too that sort of comes off as a little disingenuous from the Dodgers side is that they were pretty well out in front of like puffing their chest out when the sort of Chapman trade, which was agreed upon, but then they backed out of it when sort of the news came out of his incident where he fired a gun.
And I was proud of the Dodgers in that moment. And I was maybe sillily expecting something similar here to where,
right.
You know, yeah, maybe for whatever reason, I don't think you can go into degrees that much in this situation. Maybe you can in a court of law. But here, if you did something like this, you're not deserving of being cheered for in a major league game.
Yeah,
and it seemed like the Dodgers were beating that drum. And now that it kind of happens in this way, they get all wishy-washy. And that pisses me off.
Yeah, it happened with Roberto Osuna thing, too, because his suspension ended when the Astros were at Dodger Stadium last year. So the Dodgers, again, got to sort of puff their chest out because I think Mark Walter and Stan Kasten that weekend, if I remember right, were sort of talking about it just generally. And it was like, yeah, we can't have this kind of a thing here. And, like, you know, they get to when it's not part of their organization and it's a guy they didn't sort of trade for, and then, like, it fell through because of – and then it makes you cynical. Like, did the trade – fall through because they have standards or because they don't want the heat of the PR, you know, like that's where it sort of comes from. So, and it's always like this cover your ass mentality, like, and look, like, some fans completely right to be like angry. And like, I know with Addison Russell, like a lot of Cubs fans and Rollis Chapman too, when he was like doing good things, Cubs fans were like, every time Chapman would pitch or like when Russell was batting, they would like put out calls for like donations to like, you know, domestic violence sort of charities to sort of help people, victims of that. So I suspect we'll probably see something like that here. I will say this. I was reading a lot of stuff over the weekend about this and just like three different sort of fan thoughts on this. Aaron Falk has a nice tweet thread about it. Amanda Smith has a very long tweet there about it. I think they share your sentiment. Jeff Snyder, another Dodger fan, has a very long thread, very rational about it, and like sort of erred on the side of like, it's just like there's no. It's easy to say like zero tolerance. His sort. I'm summing up. I'm trying not to put words in his mouth, but it's easy to say zero tolerance with without like any nuance, but there's always nuance. He tried to find the nuance, and I thought he did a pretty good job of explaining sort of the rationale behind it. So I'm going to link to all those in the show notes, but that's where we're at.
I guess one thing, because I was reacting very emotionally, just kind of taking things in. I don't know. Like, I think my bare minimum, and if I thought about this more, I might go even more extreme, maybe even closer to zero tolerance. I don't know. But at a bare minimum, I think an extreme public contrition needs to occur before you should be allowed, again, this privilege of playing in Major League Baseball. I don't think that's occurred. I also don't think it's possible for that to occur in the course of a season. I don't necessarily think the Dodgers needed to release him outright right away. They wanted to retain that for a little bit, but he should not pitch the rest of this year. I really do think that. I'm disappointed to learn that that's probably not going to be the case. I know a lot of Cubs fans that, you know, again, in that World Series where Chapman was so effective, just had these, like, you know, this should have been one of the happiest moments of the last century for a lot of these fans. And it was, and it was, but it was the fact that it was tainted at all was just such a disappointment. And I'm disappointed to learn that if the Dodgers do that again, I'm in the same boat.
Right. It's really, and again, I don't want to make light of any of this, because like the actual victim here, with Urias is the sort of one who is the real victim, but like it really puts fans in tough spots because you're like, man, you want to root for something you believe in and like that stands for things that you stand for. And if you don't get that at a bare minimum, like that can be, it can be like heart wrenching, you know, like, and sort of gutting. And I completely understand. And it's, I'm going to be interested to see what kind of reception he gets. Cause it was pretty lukewarm. Like after no one really, he didn't really get much of any reaction, after the May incident, but I think there was a lot of sort of, a lot of stuff was up in the air at the time too. So be interesting to see his first game back at Dodger Stadium, whether he gets, booed or cheered or what. It's going to be something to watch.
And I'm looking forward to reading all of the Twitter threads you're linking to, because I hadn't read all of them. I'm excited to see if I can get a little bit more solid other than just feeling really disappointed and really upset.
Yep.
Well, we have 5 questions from Craig. We need to do a quick ad break, and we'll be back after that. I almost forgot Dodgers Rewind, but you have one for this week. And you normally go to players maybe I've heard in passing or maybe I've never heard of at all. I've heard of this guy.
Okay, before I go into it, so Frank Howard is our Dodger Rewind this week. Do you know what Frank Howard's nickname or nicknames were?
I do not.
Okay, so the two main ones are Hondo, which is, you know, a little bit easy, but Hondo is a fun word to say, so I like it. But also, since he played for a lot of years and it was hitting home runs with the Washington Senators, the Capital Punisher.
That
is a kick-ass nickname. Okay, so with Max Muncy getting to 30 home runs and us talking about home runs, Cody Bellinger got to 40. I was looking up the sort of list of Dodgers with 30 home runs in a season, and Frank Howard happened to be the first to do so when they were in Los Angeles. So he hit 31 home runs in 1962, the first year of Dodger Stadium. That was a weirdly strong offensive year. I know a lot of the Dodgers of the 60s are well known for pitching, and the offense, part of it was the league, part of it was Dodger Stadium, suppressing runs. But like 62 was also an expansion year, so that was part of it. But like that was a wild offensive year. Like Tommy Davis drove in like 153 runs, like which not been touched since like in franchise history. So Frank Howard was huge that year. He signed out of Ohio State. This was before the draft. So 1958, he signed. He was the Rookie of the Year in 1960. He was the first L.A. Dodger to win Rookie of the Year, the fifth overall Dodger to win a Rookie of the Year. So he was the only Dodger to hit 30 home runs from 1958 to 1973. Now, if you had to guess, how many total 30 home run seasons have there been in Dodger history, including Brooklyn?
Including Brooklyn.
Yeah, and I'm going to ask this two parts. One is how many total seasons and how many different players have hit 30?
Okay, let's. I'm going to take 5 seconds and just shout out a number.
I love it.
23 seasons, 16 players.
Oh, man, you are so low on this. I was hoping you'd say something. So it's actually 23 total players.
Okay. But, so, see, yeah. I was getting there.
I was like, oh, is he going to say it? He's going backwards. Okay. And then 52 Whoa. Total seasons. Whoa. Yeah. So of the 23 players, the most are Duke Snider and Gil Hodges. Understandable. They were just mashing in the 50s. 6 seasons each. Eric Karros, 5, and it was 5 in a 6-year stretch. And then the pair of catchers, Mike Piazza, Roy Campanella, with 4 each. So just look at that, like those Ebbets Field Boys of Summer teams had.
I think I was probably discounting the Brooklyn years in my big estimation.
So what was your total? You said 23 total seasons.
Yeah. But I meant players, clearly.
It's 34 in LA, so closer. Like, all right, so I'll give you that. So the best part, the most distinguishing characteristic about Frank Howard is that he's freaking huge. Like, he was listed, mind you, listed is never accurate, but he was listed at 6'7", 258, which means he was probably 7'4", 480.
You sent me this baseball card that has a very cute cartoon.
Yeah, and that's going to be in the post. I love the old baseball cards that had the little like cartoons on the back. And so the note in this baseball card, 1965 Tops, Frank was named National League Rookie of the Year in 1960, and it shows a like sort of
kind of Monopoly art.
Yes,
expect
exactly.
This that's on a community chest.
Right. Like, you just won $10, second place in a beauty contest. Here's your trophy. But the man holding the trophy and trying to hand it to Howard does not come up to Howard's belt buckle. And you don't even see, like, more than, like, a few inches of Howard's torso, and it's out of the frame because he's such a tall man. So it's a beautifully executed cartoon on this baseball card. He played in one World Series with the Dodgers, 1963. He started 3 of the 4 games. The Dodgers swept that series against the Yankees. He homered in game 4. It was the first World Series home run at Dodger Stadium. So in his, he sort of had 5 full seasons. He played parts of 7 seasons with the Dodgers, 125 OPS plus. That's tied for 28th in franchise history. I think the minimum is 2,000 plate appearances. He had like 2,300. Ron Say also had a 125 OPS plus, to give you an idea of the production that Howard had. Very good. Ron Say and 2 others were at 125. But he was traded in a big trade. Like, the Dodgers were a very good team in the 60s. They nearly made the World Series in 62. They lost in the playoff to the Giants. They made the World Series and won the World Series in 63. They had some injuries in 64 and did not make the playoffs. Or it was only a World Series then, so it was World Series or bust. So heading into that winter meetings, the Dodgers sort of needed to make a change. They felt they needed pitching help. So they made a trade with the Washington Senators. It was a 5-for-2 deal. The two big names that went to the Senators are Frank Howard and Ken McMullen. Ken's a third baseman. Excuse me. He actually was like really good for the Senators once he left. Like, if you look at it, like, if you just sort of like count the war, as people like to say, this trade was really good for the Senators, but it was also sort of a win-win because while the Senators got Frank Howard and McMullen, the Dodgers got Claude Osteen, which sort of helped anchor their pitching staff. They already had Drysdale and Koufax, and like some of the other pitchers are sort of faltering at this time, and Osteen gave him a like very reliable third starter, helped him win the 65 World Series. They got to the 66 World Series and lost. Osteen ended up pitching 9 seasons for the Dodgers, and then was traded. But like, Howard flourished with the Senators. He had a 156 OPS plus in his first 7 years. That was before the Senators moved to Texas. In those years, he averaged 34 home runs and 96 RBIs. And keep in mind, like, this was the end of the 60s when there was it was hard to score, and Howard was like basically a one-man offense in many of those years. So he led the AL with 44 home runs in 68 and 70. In between, he hit 48 home runs in 69, didn't lead the league that year. But like that's where he sort of got the capital punisher. Geez, I can't talk. Capital punisher nickname. So yeah, very sort of notable player because of his size and very affable and one of sort of the most memorable Dodgers we've ever seen.
You mentioned the first Dodger, the LA Dodger, the 30 home runs. Sissy emailed us a question that relates very closely. Dodgers have two. We've talked about a lot so far this episode, Bellinger and Muncy with 30. She wanted to know, can two more get there? Can the Dodgers have a quartet of 31 home runs, 30 home run players this year?
Now, so her, are we
you and I interpreting this question differently?
Well, no, I sort of, except I'm going to answer this in a Dodger way, but the way she worded it, she did not actually mention the Dodgers. Oh. It's implied that. So I sort of expanded it to try to figure out like if the other teams more other than the Dodgers can do it, and there are a few. But so from the Dodgers perspective, they already have Bellinger 42, Muncy 31. They're there. Jock Peterson has 24. He's been sort of sitting in that range for a while. He only has 4 home runs in his last 32 games post All-Star break. There's still 36 games left in the season. And, like, honestly, Jock is, like, a super streaky hitter. Like
super streaky, and he's a candidate for getting a lot of playing time in September, I think.
Well, I just think his thing is, like, he has the most starts on the team against righties, mm-hmm. and I think that's going to continue. So, like, he's going to have opportunity. So he has a chance to get there, but then the other one who has the better chance to get there to 30, I think, which would be for the first time, is Justin Turner. He's at 22, but it's a sneaky 22 because – he had 10 home runs at the All-Star break, and he has 12 home runs in 34 games since. He's been on fire with the power stroke. So very much more likely, I think, I'm more confident that he'll hit 8 home runs than Jock will hit 6. But I actually think both have a pretty good shot to get there. So the Dodgers have done this twice. In 1977, famously, they were the first team to ever do it. And then nobody ever did it again until the Rockies came into play, and they did it in 1995. They did it for 4 out of 5 years. The Dodgers also did it in 1997. So those are the only two times the Dodgers have done it. The last team to do it in baseball was the 2009 Phillies. So there's been 12 total teams that have done it. I was looking at this year. So I think to be sort of eligible to have four hit 30, you have to, we're at like nearing the 80% mark of the season now. So I went a little lower. I think you have to have at least 4 guys with at least 20 now. Like you can't, no, someone could make a run from like 17 or 18 or whatever, but yeah, it's going to be tough. But the Twins, so they have like 6 guys with already with 20. Kepler and Nelson Cruz have over 30. Rosario has 27. Somebody named Mitch Garver, he's the catcher, he has 23. Miguel Sano has 23, and then CJ Cron has 20. So just from sheer volume, they might be able to do it. And they have the most home runs in baseball, so certainly possible. The Astros, always powerful. Bregman has 30 already. Springer has 26. Yuli Gurriel has 25. Jose Altuve has 22. Maybe tough that Altuve hits another 8, but like certainly possible. It gets a little tougher now. The Red Sox, Martinez has 28, excuse me. Rafael Devers has 27. Xander Bogaerts has 27. Then Mookie Betts has 21. We saw like Mookie Betts can get hot at any time. He won the MVP last year. He could certainly hit 9 the rest of the way, but that's going to be a tough sled for all 4 of those guys to hit 30, I think, mostly because of Betts. The Cubs, their 4th guy is Anthony Rizzo with 23. They have Baez and Schwarber at 28 and Chris Bryant at 25, so they're in good shape. The other ones are like with 4 guys with 20 are long shots. The Indians, they're Carlos Santana, 29, Lindor, 21, Jose Ramirez and Roberto Perez with 20. So that's a long shot. I don't think that's going to happen. The A's have a tough one because they have Matt Chapman of 29, Matt Olson with 25, Marcus Semien with 21, so certainly possible. But then their fourth bet is Ramon Laureano with 21, but he has like a shin thing. He's not going to play till September, so they're out. The Padres really got screwed by this because they were of the Padres in Petco Park of all places. Hunter Renfroe already there, 31. Manny Machado was 26. They Franmil Reyes had 27 home runs, but he got traded to the Indians, so not going to happen. Unless the Indians release him and the Padres sign him for September and he hits three more home runs, that's possible. But then also their fourth option was Fernando Tatis Jr. with 22, and the way he was hitting, I think he would have definitely got there. But he's out for the season with a back injury, so yeah, it's looking unlikely. So of those teams, I think the Twins and the Astros have the best shot. Actually, maybe the Twins and the Cubs, and then the Astros like right there. But the Dodgers have a pretty good shot.
All right, we don't have a jingle for questions from Craig yet, but we've been told we're going to get one.
Oh man, the tease! I love it.
I'm excited. And here's another tease: the most appetite-inducing food question Craig's ever asked us, for me at least, is on this list.
I've seen it. Sometimes I don't look at the questions at a time. This time I did, and it's a good question.
With the New York Yankees coming to Dodger Stadium this week, I'm reminded that the World Series of 77, 78, and 81 made such an impact on me because they made the Yankees the Dodgers rival. I wanted to know which sports rivalry stands out for you, especially if it happened in early fandom. He has a good guess for you because it's a classic rivalry he thinks is your answer. And for me, he's wondering if it has to do with the Colts.
Yeah, so he's right with me. Like, so I didn't start following basketball till like 86, 87. And this was the end of a stretch where the Lakers and Celtics met three times in 4 years in the finals. And they had the classic rivalry back in the 60s, although back then it was more of a hammer and nail rivalry. And the Lakers were the nail. It's one of those things where like I got retroactively mad at 1984 when the Celtics beat the Lakers in seven games in a very winnable series for the Lakers. And I wasn't even around to watch it when it happened, but like, it was such a good series that when I go back and like look at it, I'm retroactively mad about it, which sort of makes for a good rivalry. And then it was dormant for a while. The Lakers, either the Lakers were good and the Celtics weren't, or the Celtics were good and the Lakers weren't for a while. When that rivalry got sort of rekindled with the 2008 finals, the Celtics beat the Lakers then. I've said this before, growing up, I loved the Lakers and Magic Johnson is my favorite all-time athlete. And those championships are wonderful. When they won with Shaq and Kobe, those were cool too in 2000, 2001, 2002. Not quite the same as the Magic years for me. But then like when they won again in 2009, when they beat the Magic, I just remember I was watching that with my nephew and his wife. And when it was over, like I didn't feel anything. Like, it's a weird thing to say because, you know, like it's a championship, you should be like elated. But I was just like, okay. Like maybe I'm just kind of over basketball now. But then in 2010, they played the Celtics again. And it was sort of a revenge series for the Lakers. And then they got over the hump. And I was so pumped for that series. And the rivalry flooded back to me so much so that when the Lakers clinched the series in game seven, I literally jumped for joy like when as the buzzer was sounding. So like, so that is clearly it for me, Lakers Celtics. And it's not really close.
I have two answers here differently in terms of emotional involvement in that a loss to this team hurt way more than anyone else. And a win, seldom as they were, was so much sweeter. Craig is right. It was the Colts Patriots rivalry in the mid aughts. They lost a lot. They won a couple of regular season games and one very, very big playoff game in 2006. Don't follow football much anymore, period. So that's sort of lost it. But I remember what it felt like back then. The therapeutic text messages between my brother and I as we would try to recuperate from usually a really hard loss. But have you seen the episode of The Simpsons, City of New York versus Homer Simpson?
Yes.
So Homer's relationship with New York City is my relationship with San Francisco, which was only anchored by the Barry Bonds Giants. So I would say I as well have just a natural rivalry with the city of San Francisco. It really is a lovely city, but it seems like every time I'm there, all of my luck just goes away and just bad stuff happens. And then, yeah, booing Barry Bonds was just always a lot of fun.
That's pretty good.
Question two, moving the food question up from its question five. No, we're not doing this. The food question comes last.
Food is last.
So third question. Yeah. Justin Turner is currently ninth in B-War for an LA Dodger position with 27 B-War. He's also fifth in the National League for position players from 2014 to present. I don't want to say he's undervalued or taken for granted, but do you think what he has done as a Dodger is fully appreciated?
No.
Yeah.
He is undervalued, I think, because, like, you just look at it, like, just from a Dodgers perspective. Well, look, he mentioned it. Like, he's one of the top, like, 5 or 10 hitters in the National League since he's become a Dodger, and that enough is, like, really good. But just looking at him, like, when it comes to, like, Dodger third baseman, he's already sixth all-time in games played at third base in the franchise. He has 626 games. He's going to pass Cookie Lavigetto this year. He'll pass Billy Cox at some point early next year. And then after that, it's only Ron Say, who is miles ahead, Adrian Beltre, and then Jim Gilliam. And Gilliam, in his career, played more games at second base than third. And Turner could actually pass him next year. So he trails among third basemen in Dodger history. He only trails Ron Say and Adrian Beltre. He's already at 3.7 WAR this year. He had five straight years of four WAR or higher. He averaged 4.7 the last 5 years. And that included, like, 2014, when he was basically like a utility guy and a fill-in for, like, Juan Uribe, but he played all over. And he still, like, had a four-win season. Like, he had, like, over 300 plate appearances. So he played his way into where he is. But, like, oh, so I was looking this up. I was trying to figure out a way to do this. The fact that he hit four WAR in every season so far, and he's almost going to do it this year. So it's going to be six straight years. Who do you think has the most four-win seasons with the Dodgers?
Dodgers, period?
Yes.
Oh, man. That's a fun question.
I will give you the top. The top two are in Brooklyn.
Top two in Brooklyn. Okay, so I was going there. Gil Hodges.
Hodges is tied for, well, it's not really fourth, but he has six straight years. He's one of three players with six.
Okay.
So, but yeah, there's three slots ahead of him.
It's interesting because you have to go the word I can't say right now, apparently.
Longitude. Oh, wait, no.
let's see. Roy Campanella. Campanella. I can't say that name.
Campanella, also one of the ones with six. I will give away another one of the Sixers. Zach Wheat, also with six.
It was literally going to be my next guess.
Yeah.
Duke Snyder.
He is second with eight. Okay. Eight seasons, not in a row, but 8 4-win seasons with the Dodgers.
I'm tapping out.
Okay, so the good longevity answer, if you're going with the Dodgers, and maybe not for total excellence, it's either Willie Davis, Bill Russell, or Pee Wee Reese.
Pee Wee Reese, okay.
And so Pee Wee Reese, Hall of Famer, 11 seasons of 4 wins with the Dodgers.
Yeah, I guess because he's one of those classic should he actually be in the Hall of Fame kind of guys.
Yes.
And so I assumed that maybe he didn't actually get to four all that often. So that surprised me a little bit. His name definitely came up a lot, and my guessing.
He was Steady Eddie, basically, like he was like the Rock for that forever. And the other ones are Ron Say, Willie Davis, which I mentioned, and Jackie Robinson had 7 years of 4 wins. So Turner's going to be in that group with like six or more. That's only 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's 8 players so far, and then it'll be 9 with Turner.
And the who do we still think of decades after they've played as just pinnacle Dodgers.
And that's the thing, like Mike Piazza, you know, was traded away, so he didn't get there because of that. He had 4 seasons. And it's clearly like, you know, he would have probably got there, but that's being here is showing up is like the main component of this. And Turner's definitely shown up, but also where I think he sort of like sort of sets his bar, at least in a, in the franchise lore. He's one of, if you look at this era, right, they're going to end up, they're going to win seven straight divisions. They've gone to at least two World Series. They're favored to go this year, I think. If you just look historically, there's been like three anchors, and it's Kershaw, Kenley Jansen, and basically Justin Turner. Mm-hmm. Like those are the big three, right?
No, whenever and, we get it, you and I get a question about the Hall of Fame, Kershaw's the easy answer. And then I think, well, who's going to, I even forget, what's this new Ring of Honor or whatever they do?
Oh, right. Legends of Dodger Baseball. Yeah.
Justin Turner is easily the first name because he's not going to make the Hall of Fame, but he right. is the face of this team. He's the leader of this team, of this era. Yes. Not just this team, this era of Dodger Baseball.
He's a prime candidate for Legends of Dodger Baseball. His postseason numbers, 313, 420, 503. He's the all-time franchise leader with 30 runs batted in the postseason. He's third with seven home runs. So he's played 49 games. He's tied with a few others. I think Andre Ethier is one of the ones with 49. This still blows my mind. It's going to be past this year, but all-time, do you remember who the all-time postseason games played leader is for the Dodgers?
I've gotten this question wrong before, and I'm going to get it wrong again.
It's Yasiel Puig, which is just wonderful. So Duke Snider, all of his games were in the World Series, obviously, because the game was different. He played in 36 games, but he had 11 home runs, which is very impressive. 26 RBIs, so more per game, but not as many as Turner. Steve Garvey, he played in 45 games. Like that, I know. Like the postseason's different now with more rounds and stuff. But and Garvey had the LCS, but it was a 5-game LCS back then. He played in 45 postseason games with the Dodgers. Like it just shows you that that's a lot of games. Like because the Dodgers they keep going to the postseason, and they played a lot of games. But like so did the Dodgers of the 70s too, and that 81 team. So Garvey hit 10 home runs in the postseason, had 22 RBIs. So those are like the big sort of three. Production-wise in the postseason. And yeah, so Turner definitely underrated, I think. But yeah, he'll be looked upon very, very fondly once his career's over.
All right, running out of time. We're going to get through these next two quick. You ready?
Yep.
This is now the fifth straight season of eight or more Dodgers with 10 or more home runs. This is notable because prior to 2015, it had only been done four times in Dodger franchise history. So here's the question. Four Dodgers are within three home runs of hitting their 10th home run. David Freese, Chris Taylor, AJ Pollock, or Matt Beaty. Who will be next?
Okay, so the Freese is the closest, but he's also not going to be back till September. Chris Taylor and Kike Hernandez both scheduled to like return Tuesday. He's at 8. AJ Pollock's at 8. So there's going to be a bit of a roster crunch. My answer is going to be Chris Taylor, by the way. Matt Beaty has 7. They're going to activate Taylor and Kike presumably on Tuesday. The easy option is Kyle Garlick gets sent back to AAA. You could option Matt Beaty, but they definitely like him as a pinch hitting option. And like Christopher Negron becomes a little bit redundant, but at the same time, you really have to be confident in the health of Taylor and Kike, I think, because the Negron's here because he could play short and play all over. And, like, they don't necessarily need him.
What do you think the likelihood of Christopher Negron getting a little bit of neck tightness?
Right. So I was saying that. So that's the option. Like, you could designate him for assignment and then probably lose him, but maybe unlikely. But he could have the mysterious back injury that requires exactly 12 days of rehab, and he'll be just fine on September 1st. Or AJ Pollock's been dealing with a groin injury. He has been hitting, but he's been playing, like, maybe every other day. But then also getting replaced in those games, and he can't really run. So maybe now that you have Taylor and Kike back, who could both play outfield and infield, maybe Pollock's the guy you put on the DL to sort of keep Negron around, because you're going to have him for depth. You want him for depth in September as a just-in-case option, I think. I think that's probably what they do, but it's a guess. But for me, it makes it more likely that Taylor's going to be the next guy to hit 10.
AJ Pollock is my answer. Final question, except not the final question. How many different starting pitchers will the Dodgers use in the 16-game straight stretch they have starting on Tuesday, and who will they be?
Okay, so this is easier for me because of that 16 games, the 12 of those are in August, and then it goes stretches into the first 4 days of September. And Stripling's not going to be back till September. Dustin May is basically working out of the bullpen now. Gonsolin's in the rotation. I think they've been sort of trying to figure out what to do there. I think they use six in these 16 games, and it's just the regular six. Like, it's your big three of Ryu, Kershaw, Buehler, and then Maeda, Gonsolin, and then May. I think they may might slot in, even if it's a bullpen game type start, just to sort of give everyone an extra day during that 16 days like they like to do. But, yeah, I don't think that there's really any other candidate really to start at this point.
I think the only other candidate would be if they wanted to, for whatever matchup reasons, do a different opener on a bullpen game. I think that would be the only other option.
But and I still think we'd be at six because probably Dustin May would be in the bullpen.
I think the number is right. It's just the who that six could be could change. All right.
I agree.
The actual final question.
Right. Food question.
Moving the food question. Oh, you're right. We didn't move it up. Sorry, Greg. With the Yankees in town, here's a sandwich question. Before going to a game this weekend, do you get a pastrami sandwich from one of the fine delis like Laner's or Cantor's? Do you go full LA and get a French dip from Philippe's? Or maybe, and this is Craig is correct in his guess, Jacob would go to a place near where he worked in Santa Monica, Bay City's Deli, for a godmother. I've been talking about this with my wife. I have not found a Italian sandwich anywhere close. And not that I expect to get one as good, but at least maybe in the ballpark as the godmother at Bay Cities. And I haven't. I miss it. It's so, so good. It's probably one of the first things I'm going to have except for after In-N-Out when I get back in L.A. Later in September.
Yeah, so we were talking about this before. I think, now that I think about it, I think I've been to Cantor's?
Cantor's is one of those places where the food is fine, but you are more going for its location on Fairfax and its ambiance and and the fact that it's open 24 hours.
But I haven't been to Langer's.
So the answer, if you want to be a full... this is just what sandwich do you want the most, Godmother's my answer. But if you want to really stick it to the Yankee fans that are going to show up, you can go to Laner's, get a number 19, and get the actual best pastrami in the world, which isn't at Katz. I've had Katz, I've had Schwartz's in Montreal, and I've had Laner's. Laner's is the best.
I like it. So the Philippe's is the most likely option, I think, that I would do. Just
location-wise, it's the easiest,
However, I was asking a question about Dodger Dogs on Twitter today, and that got a ton of responses. But someone also mentioned to me just in passing that there's a place on Spring Street. I think it's Spring and, like, 6th. Or it's actually right near, maybe not 6th, but it's off of Cesar Chavez and Spring. It's near Philippe's. It's called Spring Street Smokehouse. And I looked, and it looks like a pretty good place. So I think I might try that this weekend. So maybe I'm going outside the box on this one. And it fits the criteria of me not going out of my way at all. And it's like perfectly on my route to the stadium. So I might do that.
When I'm in LA, one of these, I'm going to be in LA September, once in September, once in October, and once in December. Mm-hmm. You and I are going to get some pastrami and your life is going to change.
I'm busy. No, I'm just kidding. That sounds good. Yeah, are you saying pastrami cures all ills?
I do.
No? All right, well, that's perfect. Everyone go out there and have a pastrami sandwich, and we'll talk to you next week.